Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Vice President Kamala Harris touches down in Guatemala. Journalist Enrique Acevedo joins me to discuss America's daunting task of stemming migration. And
democracy itself is in peril.
Warnings of an authoritarian wave. Obama's foreign policy advisor Ben Rhodes explains who is to blame in his new book, After the Fall. Then
I cannot give up this platform to promote complacency and peace when there is a war on my body and a war on my rights.
A Texas valedictorian goes off script and stuns the crowd. Paxton Smith tells me what drove her to speak about the highly charged issue of abortion. Plus,
it's all part of this broader idea that women don't belong in sports and that you're only here. You should be happy just to be here.
Sports writer Julie DeCaro talks to Michelle Martin about her book Sidelined and the unfair treatment of famous female athletes.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Bianca Ladriga in New York, sitting in for Christiane Amanpour. Vice President Kamala Harris is on the ground in Guatemala today, her first foreign trip in office, in an attempt to stem the flow of migrants headed to the U.S. southern border. Harris met with that country's president as well as community leaders to discuss the issues forcing people to flee their homes, like violence, corruption, climate, and poverty.
First, on the issue of security, is probably one of the highest priorities for each of our nations. The President and I agreed to continue our work to manage migration at Guatemala's northern and southern borders. We also discussed illicit drugs that are being smuggled and humans who are being trafficked across those borders, undermining the security of both the people of Guatemala and the people of the United States.
Border encounters reached a two-decade high in April, according to the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, and nearly half of the migrants were from Central America. Next, Harris will go to Mexico, where a vote held on Sunday appears to have put a dent in its president's grip on power following an extremely violent election season. Enrique Acevedo is a Mexican-American journalist, currently a correspondent for 60 Minutes Plus, and he is joining me now from Miami. Enrique, great to have you on the program. So let's begin with the vice president's first day there, touching ground in Guatemala, and reiterating her view and the administration's view that if given the chance, people would not flee their homes. It is because of outside factors, be it poverty, be it corruption, be it violence. Given that, do you think that this can be a more successful trip and a start to really stemming this crisis, or is this just yet another layer of administrations trying to address this without any end results?
Thanks, Bianca. That's a great question. I think the Biden administration is hoping they can put a fresh perspective and have better results than previous administrations, including the Obama administration, when then Vice President Biden was very much involved in immigration policy and in trying to address these root causes of immigration that Vice President Harris has repeatedly mentioned before her trip. We know about bad governance, the lack of economic opportunity, violence in many of these countries. But now new factors like climate change, disinformation campaigns fueling the migrant caravans that we've seen in recent months, and of course, the effects of the pandemic are also at play in the region. So it's going to be interesting to see what Vice President Harris highlights during her visit to Guatemala, if that's very different from what she asks from Mexico's government in terms of not just addressing root causes, but helping to minimize the flow of migrants coming from Latin America into the United States. That's also something that's been reported, The U.S. wants these countries, Guatemala and Mexico, to stop the flow of migrants coming in so they don't have to manage immigration at the U.S.-Mexico border.
And it's interesting because exactly this month, 7 years ago, then Vice President Biden was also in Guatemala addressing some of these same issues. And in January of 2015, he wrote an op-ed in the New York Times. And I want to read it to you because not much has really changed. He wrote, "The economies of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras remain bogged down as the rest of the Americas surge forward. Inadequate education, institutional corruption, rampant crime, and a lack of investment are holding these countries back. 6 million young Central Americans are to enter the labor force in the next decade. If opportunity isn't there for them, the entire Western Hemisphere will feel the consequences." So here we are, years later, and not much has changed. We have seen a new generation of young Latin Americans who are feeling the same, and Central Americans who are feeling the same frustration. What, if anything, do you see different that this administration can offer?
The lack of hope that's driving many of those young migrants to the U.S. And also, it has to be said, in our reporting for 60 Minutes Plus, we were recently at the border trying to address this cycle of every 1 or 2 years where we see an increase in unaccompanied minors, in migrant families, and we lack the nuance, the historical context that you just provided in your introduction. So I think what's changed is this fresh perspective. You have people like Samantha Power at the heading USAID, an agency that's going to be key in addressing these root causes. Many people complain that, you know, we shouldn't spend money on governments that have a history of corruption and bad governance. It's important to understand that Vice President Harris is not going to El Salvador and Honduras, where corruption and bad governance are certainly at play with the leaders of both countries. But again, going back to your question, I think what's different now is that they want to work with grassroots organizations. They want to work directly with communities. They're thinking of new creative ways of giving the resources directly to them and not having to go through that middleman that in the past has proven to be very unsuccessful. What's also different is that, well, they are allowing unaccompanied minors to come into the country. They're not letting them remain at the border or housing them in those facilities that we've seen at the border indefinitely. There seems to be a better processing system now, but in the end, all of this is going to really have to be measured in terms of results, not just now, but in the next couple of years.
Yeah, and the vice president has announced $310 million in aid and assistance for food shortages. But I guess this goes back to a point you just made. It's a delicate balance between how much authority and oversight the U.S. has in these countries that have been dealing with corruption for decades. I know you mentioned trying new avenues and maybe eliminating the middleman, but there still needs to be some oversight and there still needs to be a role, obviously, that the governments themselves play. How do you see that balancing out?
I think they're trying to build a plane while flying in many ways, because they understand that they need to spend a little more money in the places where migrants are coming from to make a big difference at the U.S.-Mexico border, as opposed to spending more money, billions, in border enforcement, in border security, without making any difference in the communities that are expelling these migrants. But at the same time, the political climate in the U.S. is not lending itself to that narrative. It's going to be hard to justify that and to create the kind of oversight that you're talking about, especially when Republicans are very clear about first focusing more on border enforcement and immigration enforcement within the U.S. than on the root causes of immigration. So I think the administration is going to try different things. I think that part of the reason why Vice President Harris is right now in Guatemala and then in Mexico is going to be is going to have to do with reducing the flow of migrants. For example, there's talk about asking Mexico to impose a visa for Brazilians who are immigrating from that country, trying to go through Mexico and then cross without documents into the United States. There's talk about new ways of restricting immigration flows from Latin America, from the Northern Triangle, the so-called Northern Triangle, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, through Mexico. And we'll see what ends up in that negotiation.
Well, in Mexico will be the vice president's stop tomorrow, obviously a key player there and partner in this crisis and issue. And she will be meeting with President López Obrador. They are expected to make an announcement tomorrow, signing an agreement on migration and development with the U.S. How much should we make of this announcement? Is this sort of just something to give the administration and to show that there's some cooperation with the vice president there? Or do you think this is really something of substance?
Well, the vice president's visit to Mexico couldn't come at a more consequential time for that country. Right after the midterm elections just yesterday, that, like you said, made a dent in the kind of political power that President López Obrador had on the country. He's now forced to negotiate with other political forces in terms of domestic policy. And I think he's also forced now to negotiate with the United States in terms of finding a common solution to a regional problem, because this is not just a U.S. or a U.S.-Mexico border problem. It's really a regional crisis that is manifesting at the border. So I think we'll have to go into the details of that agreement to see if it's really something different from what we've seen in the past. There are some coincidences in the approach from both the Mexican government and the Biden administration in terms of what's needed to solve this, addressing root causes, investing in regional development. But I don't think the Mexican government wants those resources to go directly to the grassroots communities and the organizations, the civil society organizations that we were talking about. I'm guessing they'll want to manage part of that those resources. And I don't know if that's going to be possible with the Biden administration that you know, is fighting corruption.
Yeah, and AMLO, of course, called by many an authoritarian populist, had a very close relationship with President Trump, not necessarily the same with President Biden. But we are seeing the administration at least have some sort of leverage, the U.S. administration, over these countries. And that is just coming down to the pandemic and vaccines availability. We know the pandemic is ravaging these countries. I'm wondering what, if any, leverage the U.S. may be offering in terms of helping and an assistance. Obviously, we want to do that from a humanitarian standpoint, and it benefits the U.S. But would that be something that you could envision as sort of a key turning point and factor in putting more pressure on these countries to offer them more of our vaccines?
Absolutely. There's a vaccine diplomacy side of it. And like you said, it should be handled from a humanitarian perspective. 12 million people on both sides of the border depend on a vaccination campaign that's successful to reopen the border. And I highlight that part because I think there's a leverage in reopening the border, not just for essential travel, but to where it was in terms of interactions for trade, for the flow of migrants, the millions of people who depend on their businesses, on their lives, on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border. There's some leverage there. There could be an announcement in that direction tomorrow, a date to reopen the border. Right now, it remains closed. It has during the pandemic under Title 42. But we'll see what other factors come at play in that negotiation. I think the fact that Vice President Harris is there today, just one less than 24 hours after an election that didn't turn out as expected for President López Obrador, could also be an interesting factor in those talks.
Yeah, a bit more vulnerability for him than he would have anticipated. I know, Enrique, you will be covering this story as we will be following it closely as well. Thank you so much for the time. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Central America isn't the only place seeing an authoritarian creep. It's a trend emerging all over the globe and one that our next guest has spent years examining. Ben Rhodes was one of President Obama's closest foreign policy advisors, and he's putting forward a provocative theory that the United States may be partially to blame. It's all in his new book, After the Fall, Being American and the World We've Made. And he joins me now for Los Angeles with more. Ben Rhodes, welcome to the program. Great to have you on. Congratulations on the book. Before we get to the book and some of the other issues transpiring around the world, let me just pick up where we just left off with Enrique. You were in an administration that was dealing with very similar problems and the flow of migrants into the U.S. Vice President Biden at the time was tasked with this. Years later, we seem to be at this place once again. What do you make of this administration's approach versus yours, your administration's?
Well, as you were just discussing, there's a lot of commonality. And what happened is after 2014, with the surge of unaccompanied children coming from Central America, we put together this aid package for Central America. And Vice President Biden, at the time Vice President, was essentially in charge of building those relationships. The challenge, to be honest, there's no silver bullet, and this doesn't happen quickly. And so what happened is right after that aid got flowing, the Trump administration came in, pulled the plug, kind of zeroed it out, and obviously the progress that was made was lost. This is a long-term solution. You have to pursue these types of aid programs that reach people directly, as you were discussing, over several years. You're not going to see results right away. And what it takes is kind of an all-of-the-above approach, where you're working to get at root causes in Central America, you're working with Mexico on migration flows, you're working to make the asylum process work better, and you're working to have a humane approach at the border itself. But, you know, we have to have patience as a country to try to solve this problem over time, recognizing that any one trip is not going to do it, but it is going to contribute to the kind of relationships you need.
Yeah, and some skeptics may say, well, you know, question whether Vice President Harris was the right person to be tasked with this. But on the flip side, you could see that there's no person closer who has higher authority other than the president than the vice president. So obviously this suggests that he takes this very seriously and is prioritizing this. But obviously we know he's got a lot on his plate, and he will be traveling to Europe this week for meetings with the G7 and NATO. And President Biden wrote an essay over the weekend that sort of catches and talks about the issues you write about in your book and you're focused on, and that is the question of democracy. He wrote in this piece, "Can democracies come together to deliver real results for our people in a rapidly changing world? Will the democratic alliances and institutions that shaped so much of the last century prove their capacity against modern-day threats and adversaries?" Now, President Biden would like to believe yes. Where do you stand on this right now?
Well, I definitely would like to believe yes. I think that what we're facing and we have to recognize is kind of two sides of the same coin, which is the challenge of this creeping authoritarianism that you mentioned. On the one hand, you have China, which is putting forward an alternative model, really, of society, a kind of totalitarian blend of capitalism and nationalism and technology that is threatening our values and threatening our interests around the world. And I'm sure that what Joe Biden wants to do is go to Europe and see if, among other things, he can't forge kind of common positions, make common cause with our key allies about how we're going to compete with China in the long run and how we're going to, again, demonstrate that democracies can deliver for people, as he said. But at the same time, we have to recognize we're also facing huge challenges to our democracies from within. From within Europe itself, you have Vladimir Putin seeking to kind of unravel and challenge the international order that the United States has led, seeking to divide democracies against one another. You have nationalist far-right figures like Viktor Orban in Hungary, who I look at carefully in the book, who've kind of put forward an alternative model for how European countries can return to the kind of ethno-nationalism that tends to lead to dark places, Bjana. So I think that the issue we have to recognize is this isn't something we're going to solve just through our foreign policies. We have to make our democracies work at home, and we have to strengthen and kind of consolidate the democratic world so that we can weather this challenge that we're getting from authoritarians.
You spent a lot of time in Hungary and other countries, obviously, in researching your book. And I'm really interested in the sort of Putin model that Viktor Orban and others have followed. And here's a case study of somebody who was once a liberal Democrat, moved into a nationalist, right, sort of this right-wing populist. You come across the idea that a lot of that is based on some of the challenges the U.S. and other Western countries sort of impose on the rest of the world, obviously being the financial crisis, the mismanagement of COVID, what have you. What are some of the lessons learned from your experiences in researching this book?
So the first lesson is we have to see ourselves as connected to what's happening abroad. A jumping off point for me for this book, and the reason I look at Hungary, it's kind of a laboratory for this new strain of authoritarianism. I asked a young democratic activist, you know, how did your country go from being a democracy to an autocracy essentially in a decade? And he said, well, that's simple. Viktor Orban got elected on a right-wing populist backlash to the financial crisis. He redrew parliamentary districts to favor his party. He packed the courts with right-wing judges. He changed the voting laws to make it easier for his supporters to vote. He enriched some cronies on the outside who financed his politics, kind of bought up the media, turned it into a right-wing propaganda machinery. And he wrapped it all up in a nationalist bow, an us versus them nationalism. We are the real Hungarians, and the them can be immigrants, Muslims, civil society, George Soros, liberal elites. And I'm thinking, this sounds like a familiar playbook. It's what I've lived at home. And in pulling the thread on that, Bianna, what I had to reckon with is, look, the inequities in globalization led by America after the Cold War that led to that 2008 crash kind of allowed people like Viktor Orban and ultimately Donald Trump to appeal to people's sense of grievance and offer them the most familiar form of politics, which is nationalism. The explosion of technology and social media that emanated from America ended up being the kind of perfect tool for someone like Vladimir Putin to take those social media platforms and fire the toxins of disinformation and division back into our own societies. In our own kind of post 9/11 excesses in the war on terror, people like Viktor Orban and Putin himself used similar language and similar framing around national security and anti-terrorism to justify all manner of authoritarian policies. And so a lot of this had its point of origin with Vladimir Putin, who was kind of the first to develop and pursue this playbook. But we've now seen it proliferate to just about every part of the world, including right here in the United States, where on January 6th, we learned it can happen here too.
And I'm glad you brought up January 6th, because obviously we have this upcoming summit between President Biden and President Putin. And President Putin, as you and I know, both know, is famous for whataboutisms. And it appears, despite everything internally that's transpiring in his country, and we'll get to Alexei Navalny, who's in prison. I know you spoke with him as well. But despite everything that's happening within Russia, and the rise of autocracy there really quickly, he is focusing on what's transpiring in America. And he even said recently, last week, that he plans to bring this up, that the sense of all of these people who stormed the Capitol aren't necessarily being given their rights. And perhaps they didn't have the right motives, but they have their own liberties that are not being allowed to pursue here in the U.S. What do you make about that?
Well, look, I've been in the room with Putin many times when I was working for President Obama, and whataboutism is always a characteristic of these summit meetings. I remember on Ukraine, you know, he'd be denying that Russia was providing any support into eastern Ukraine. We literally have overhead imagery of huge masses of Russian military equipment flowing into eastern Ukraine. And what he'd just say is, no, you actually caused this crisis because you got behind a coup that overthrew the leader of Ukraine who Russia had backed. And you end up getting drawn into some debate with the guy. I'm sure he'll be doing the same thing to Joe Biden. I think what we have to recognize is that this is a tactic. And you know, Navalny himself told me, look, Putin's message to his own people in Russia and around the world isn't necessarily that he is pure, that he is not corrupt. It's that everybody is. And essentially, he can convince you that, look, America is just as corrupt as Russia. It's no different. It's just a different system with the same outcome. Like a handful of winners and a bunch of losers, then that's the opening for Putin to say, at least I offer you the kind of the projection of your grievances. You know, I'm making Russia great again. I'm taking on our enemies. And so that whataboutism is meant to engender cynicism, that nothing really matters. It's not worth even challenging this, that everybody is just as corrupt as everybody else. And I think it's incumbent on Joe Biden to draw the clear distinctions between what America stands for in the world and what Vladimir Putin has been up to for the better part of over two decades now.
And you spent some time, I guess this is during quarantine, so and during the pandemic, so you were FaceTiming and spending time and communicating with Alexei Navalny. Obviously, this was before he was imprisoned. And there was a connection that you finally realized that you had between the two of you that maybe drew you to him in ways you didn't expect. And that was that you operated on a sense of rage. I want to quote something from your book. You said there are different types of people, some under pressure or scared, and some people, they are more enraged. This is from Navalny. My own motivations draw on rage, even that I know that rage can distort thinking and lead you down dark alleys. Rage motivates both of you. Can you talk about that and where you think that has landed Navalny, being in prison now for, you know, this is a sentence for a couple of years. Many expect him to remain in prison much longer. He nearly died after a hunger strike and abuse there while in prison. What do you make of his tactic and his approach to Russia as he would envision it?
So first of all, Bianca, I want to thank you for the attention that you put on Alexei Navalny. I think there are two things I'd highlight. The first is the extent to which Navalny helped me understand the mindset that led to Putin. He described coming of age as the Soviet Union came apart. He's a kid in a military town outside of Moscow, and he's been taught that he comes from the greatest country in the world, and then he's getting West German army rations. And the humiliation that that engendered in him, I think, was a shared experience among Russians. And Putin tapped into that to restore the greatness of Russia. But then what Navalny did is he set out to expose the corruption of Putin, that Putin was essentially railing against the fact that Russia had created this oligarch class of billionaires, while Putin himself was enriching himself in a class of oligarchs to then use that money to take over the power of the state and control all aspects of society. And what was so interesting to me about Navalny is I said to him, look, I mean, you must get scared, right? You must be, you know, intimidated. He'd been poisoned in prison, but even when I was talking to him last summer. And he said, look, you know, if ever I needed motivation, I would just appear before a Russian judge because the lies that he would tell would give me all the motivation I need. And the thing that animated him was his sense. He never lost that sense of incredulity and outrage at corruption. That's what got him into politics in the first place. And whenever he felt like giving up, or he told me, look, I'm a normal guy. When the cell door closes behind me, when it clangs shut, I know they can do anything to me. But the thing that continued to motivate him was he didn't succumb to the apathy that a Putin wants to instill in people. He never lost his sense of being outraged at the fact that the people in charge were stealing from the rest of the country and suppressing their rights. And that's what allows him to take this incredibly courageous step of returning to Russia, knowing that he's going to be detained. And obviously the sacrifices that he is making are so much greater than what someone like me could ever make. But I think the lesson we have to take from that is authoritarians, people like Putin, people like Trump, they want you to be so turned off politics, so cynical. The world is just this way that you step aside, that you succumb. And I think what Navalny is a message to the rest of us is, no, we don't have to do that. We can stand up for what we believe. And Navalny, you know, was very clear to me, look, I'm not doing this just to be a dissident. I believe that if I could actually run an election against these guys, I would win. I don't believe, as we hear commentators say all the time, that the Russian people are just content with Putin and his brand of corruption. And I think we need to kind of bring that sense of urgency in everything we do.
And of course, every supporter of his and every other opposition leader that would like to run against Vladimir Putin has obviously been deemed an extremist now. Many are leaving and fleeing the country. We're hearing news stories by the day. I guess given all of that, I was reminded of yesterday, obviously being the anniversary of D-Day. And then you write in your book in 2014 for the 70th anniversary, you were there with President Obama and Putin was there. And you describe a scene where there was a jumbotron and a big image of Putin comes up and the crowd booed. And then a big image of Obama came up and everyone cheered and you felt very uncomfortable, but yet I guess a sense of pride too. And I'm wondering if all of these years later, all of this work that Putin is doing, not necessarily to build Russia up, but build the West and the U.S. and break it down, do you think that same thing would happen today? Would the world, would other people there be cheering on a U.S. president?
You know, I think so, Bianca. And here's the thing. In writing this book and kind of reporting and going out and talking to people from Hong Kong to Russia to Hungary and other places, you realize that the same competition plays out constantly throughout history. This isn't new. Like each generation, there's some kind of competition between the forces of nationalism and authoritarianism, people who kind of want to wind the clock back, and people who are rejecting that. And people are saying that there's a different way. And America is supposed to be the country that solve this by saying, no, we can have a national identity that is also a multiracial, multi-ethnic democracy where people can figure this out. I believe, truly believe, that despite the power structures in so many countries, more people in the world today would rather live in that kind of world where people do work it out through democracy than where they succumb to autocracy. You know, I look at Hong Kong, this is one city where they had the opportunity to opt into Chinese autocracy, and the whole city tried to opt out. And ultimately, the Chinese Communist Party was too powerful for them. But I think we have to recognize that movements fail until they succeed. And we just have to keep at it because this is the competition that is cyclical. We've seen in the past that this message is more attractive. But we have to defend democracy in this country to set an example that can then ripple out around the world.
Look, I think I succeeded in getting an optimistic side out of Ben Rhodes. Even the New York Times called this book a gloomy tour of the world. We saw a bit more optimism there, Ben. And that's always reassuring. Thank you so much.
I remain hopeful.
It. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Thanks, Bianca.
Well, next, when Texas high school valedictorian Paxton Smith took the microphone at graduation last week, nobody knew what she was going to say. Nobody. She tossed out her approved speech, took out a new piece of paper from under her gown, and went on to address the state's new abortion bill, which prohibits most abortions when a fetal heartbeat is detected as early as 6 weeks and gives no exceptions for rape or incest. Take a listen.
This is a problem, and it's a problem that cannot wait. And I cannot give up this platform to promote complacency and peace when there is a war on my body and a war on my rights. A war on the rights of your mothers, a war on the rights of your sisters, a war on the rights of your daughters. We cannot stay silent. Thank you.
This speech has now been viewed millions of times on social media and won the praise from the likes of Hillary Clinton. Paxton Smith joins me now. Paxton, welcome to the program. Great to have you on.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So walk us through a bit of the background and your process when you were coming up with this last minute speech. When did you realize that this is what you wanted to do?
Well, I was sitting in the band hall and I was trying to finish an assignment for my psychology class, and I couldn't bring myself to focus because I was so distracted by how upset I was about the passing of the heartbeat bill. So I decided to start writing some of my thoughts on the Google Doc that I had open. And I think it was in that moment that I realized that that's what I should talk about.
What really struck me, and look, I grew up in Texas, this country, and especially within Texas, there's so much polarization and so much around this issue is built on politics. But what you did and what you captured was the impact that it had on you, and especially your fellow female students, not from a political perspective, but from a personal and a developmental career perspective. I actually want to play some of the sound for our viewers to listen to this.
We have spent our entire lives working towards our future. And without our input and without our consent, our control over that future has been stripped away from us. I am terrified that if my contraceptives fail, I am terrified that if I am raped, then my hopes and aspirations and dreams and efforts for my future will no longer matter. I hope that you can feel how gut-wrenching that is. I hope you can feel how dehumanizing it is to have the autonomy over your own body taken away from you.
What's so striking about that is you are presenting this as a female valedictorian, and yet you're saying this law could uproot your potential professionally. Talk about that.
Yes, I think a lot of people have misinterpreted what I said to mean that being successful or being a mother is an either-or situation, and I don't think that at all. I personally want to be a mother, and I cannot wait for that time, but I want it to be at a point when I am emotionally, mentally, and financially capable of having a child, and when I feel like I'm ready to find that work-life balance. And I think a lot of other people feel the same way.
Were you expecting the mic to be turned off when you started speaking and giving a speech that was not the one that you had, been given a green light for? You were.
Yeah.
And did you feel more comfortable and emboldened the longer you continued to speak, knowing that the mic was not being turned off? Did that give you a signal?
I didn't. As I kept speaking, I didn't think that the mic was not going to get turned off. In fact, when I was about most of the way done with my speech, I turned to the side and I saw them giving the signal for the microphone to get cut off, but I kept speaking and I ended up getting to finish my speech.
I guess, did you weigh the consequences of what could have been, that you could have gotten into trouble with the school or the school council, the board? You weighed all of that, I would imagine, and you still were determined to give this speech. Why?
I felt like, for me, this was the right thing to do, and that what I had to say needed to be said on a platform where people who didn't care about the subject or disagreed with the subject would have to hear my voice and have to hear how it affected me. And I felt like whatever the consequences may be, even though all the ones that I considered, I was willing to take those on to get my message out.
What do you make of the response, not only worldwide, but in that went viral, but just in the moments after the speech, the round of applause that you received, the fact that you weren't reprimanded.
It was great. I was very surprised, actually, but I think it shows how many people agree with me on the topic.
Your parents knew. They were worried, as any parent would be. Not that they didn't support your decision, but they were concerned about what the consequences would be. What was their reaction after?
Afterwards, they were proud of me.
Yeah, I would imagine so. Again, I am mostly just struck about the reference you gave to this having an impact on the future careers and lives of you and your fellow female classmates. What does your future look like? I mean, I know college is next. What would you like to pursue?
Professionally, I'm not sure yet. I am 18, so I have a lot of time to figure this out. But at the moment, I'm hoping to go to college to study music.
I'm sure you've been told that you have an appeal that would generate well in politics. Is there any political future for you? I know you said you're 18. We've got many more years to decide that. But has this changed your perspective and outlook on politics?
Possibly. It's certainly a possibility that I could get involved in politics in the future.
Well, Paxton, I have to say that was a very commendable speech to give. I know that you were nervous about it, but given the reaction that you received from dignitaries and everyday citizens around the world, I think you should feel good about your decision there. And it really left people proud of you and talking about you. And we're sure that your future will be bright as well.
Thank you,
Paxton. Well, now, tennis star Naomi Osaka broke her silence over the weekend, thanking fans for their support after she withdrew from the French Open to focus on her mental health. Her decision to pull out rather than face the tournament's press conference is triggering a conversation about the relationship between athletes and the media. For insight, we turn to sports journalist Julie DeCaro, the author of Sideline: Sports, Culture, and Being a Woman in America. Here she is talking to Michelle Martin about Osaka, as well as her own experience with abuse as a woman in sport.
Thanks, Fiona. Julie DeCaro, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
People accept that there's a certain amount of, you know, trash talk involved between, you know, between athletes and then sometimes between broadcasters and athletes, not so much, but, you know, because they depend on them for access and so forth. But when did you realize that your experience as a woman sports talk host was just fundamentally different from that of your colleagues, your male colleagues?
Yeah, you know, I remember one day when one of my male colleagues got called sort of a nasty name on the text line that comes into the station and completely shut down for 15 minutes and wouldn't talk to anybody. And I sort of thought, gosh, I would kill to have that be the worst thing that people call me. You know, the responses I got from people were very gendered. They were very violent. So while men might get, you're terrible at your job and you shouldn't have this job, women get, I hope you get raped. You probably slept with your boss to get this job, you know, things along those lines. So, you know, it was when I saw the things that upset the men and realized how much worse the things that people said to me were that I really realized how different it was. And I think that women, by and large, feel like it's just me, that people, it's me because there's something wrong with me. And it wasn't until women started, we all started sort of talking to each other on, you know, private Facebook groups and things like that, that we realized that there's a lot of us in this boat.
Could you just back up for a second? Do you hear what you just said? Because I'm not sure that everybody understands what you just said. You just said, people, you know, express the desire to see me get raped. I mean, come on. Like, that's a normal part of the workday.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I've seen it happen to other women. I've talked to women in my book who said, you know, they were fighting back tears while at the same time trying to read sports scores on the radio. It is a tough, tough environment and one where I think women are largely still not accepted.
So, and this started just from the beginning. I mean, this started day one.
Yeah, it started day one. Yeah, I mean, I think there's an initial pushback to women being in a space that is largely dominated by men. So first you get complaints about your voice, about if you make a mistake, it's because you're a woman, those kinds of things. But when I started commenting on topics that are, I guess, hot button issues, things like violence against women, things like racial bias in sports, things like that, that is when it really came out. The claws really came out from other people. And I think that a lot of it is that, you know, there are certain rules where women are allowed to stay. If you look the right way, if you say the right things, if you sort of defer to the men and don't sort of wade into the debates that people get upset about, you're treated much differently. But if you are a person with opinions who speaks out and talks especially about social justice, racial justice in sports, then you are going to get a lot of vitriol sent your way.
And a couple of years ago, you and a colleague decided to let the world know what you've been experiencing. It was a YouTube video that quickly got millions of views and under the hashtag More Than Me. You and another colleague had male friends of yours, acquaintances of yours, read actual emails and tweets that were directed to you. These were not made up. I think we should play a short clip of that. Why don't we do that?
Hopefully this skank Julie DeCaro is Bill Cosby's next victim. That would be classic.
I don't know what to say to that.
I don't. I think I can even say that.
I hope your boyfriend beats you. I'm sorry.
Why bring up your own rape in this story? Is it your way of firing back at critics who said you can't get any?
That's something, huh?
I'm sorry.
And there's more.
Yeah, there's more. And Michelle, you know, those were the sort of intermediate level tweets. We couldn't even put the rated X ones on there because we were afraid YouTube would take the video down. Mm-hmm. So those were sort of those aren't even the advanced level tweets. Those were just mid-range.
So one of the reasons we're bringing this up now is that, well, two reasons. One, we're talking in the wake of Naomi Osaka decision to withdraw from the French Open because she had made the statement that she wasn't willing to participate in press conferences during the Open as a way to protect her mental health. She got a lot of pushback from that, from the tournament. And one of the reasons that we called you is that you wrote a book, not just about those experiences, your experiences as a woman in sports media, but also you broadened it out to the experiences of women athletes. So what's your response to the Naomi Osaka decision?
I think the misogyny that's directed against women, particularly women of color, is all part of the same thing, right? Whether you're on the media side, whether you're an athlete, it's all part of this broader idea that women don't belong in sports and that you're only here. You should be happy just to be here and you should play along with the rules and accept the way things have always been. I think that what Naomi Osaka has done is incredibly brave. I think it sparked a conversation in media that we need to have. And it's a conversation on so many levels, right? It's about men. Mental health. It's about the way that we treat women and women of color in sports. It's about the way that the media treats athletes in general. And certainly we've seen other athletes come forward and sympathize with her and talk about how hard press conferences are for them. So I'm kind of shocked by the blowback that she's gotten from this. It seems like it was such a simple request. And it seems like it would have been such a simple thing for them to do. Just say, okay, you know, we're excusing her for this tournament. And afterwards, we'll have a conversation about it. And then we can move forward and see what we can do to help her going forward. But, you know, that wasn't the response. And I think that, you know, I think that the reason this has blown up to such an extent and is involving, you know, people in this conversation who don't care about sports or tennis or any of it is that it is a woman. It is a woman of Japanese and Haitian descent pushing back against the status quo and the way things have always done in an industry dominated largely by white men.
You know, I think a lot of people would be surprised to hear you say this because you are a sports writer. And some of the blowback has come from sports journalists who basically say, hey, you know, we need access to these athletes. And, you know, they're actually quite, you know, irritated. And so I think people would be surprised to hear you as a person who's been a part of those press scrums and has, you know, fought for access to say that this is a legitimate concern.
Yeah. And certainly some of my colleagues who I respect very much, I disagree with. I think that, you know, most by and large, 90% of the people in sports media scrums and in these press conferences are incredibly professional, who do their jobs very professionally. But, you know, I saw Renee Stubbs, former doubles champ, say that she feels that these press conferences have been over-credentialed, that there are maybe people in these press conferences who shouldn't be there. Maybe people who don't cover tennis regularly or people who don't necessarily know that much about the sport. And, you know, I saw Vice pulling out some of the questions that Naomi Osaka has been asked, and some of the other women have been asked. Maria Sharapova at 15 was asked how she felt being a pinup, if she felt that was okay. Eugenie Bouchard was asked to twirl around and show people her outfit. Naomi Osaka has been asked, why is your last name Osaka when your dad is Haitian? You know, I mean, just things that have nothing to do with tennis, have no place really being asked by people. And, you know, especially since Naomi Osaka has been someone who very courageously has spoken out against police brutality. She talked about the murder of George Floyd. She infamously wore face masks of people who had been murdered by police at the U.S. Open. You know, things that she's going to be asked about. She's of Japanese descent. COVID is taking hold in Tokyo. The Olympics are coming up. I'm sure they're going to ask about that. And I think that, you know, if you are someone who suffers from anxiety and depression, like she has said she does, that you really worry about setting a foot wrong and upsetting people and saying the right thing. And I think that's got to be huge for a 23-year-old woman in the middle of the French Open. I mean, you only get 4 chances a year to add Grand Slams to your resume. These are precious opportunities. And I think the fact that she would rather walk away and give that up then face the press is a reason that the press sort of needs to take a look in the mirror and figure out why she feels that way and what we've done to contribute to it.
Do you think that this intrusive behavior is particularly directed at women and beyond that, even women of color? You know, I think a lot of people, a lot of the fans are saying, hey, that's what you signed up for. That's just how it is in sports in general. So what's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that women, and particularly women of color, have different kinds of questions directed to them. I just saw, and I think it's a Cambridge study, that talks about the words the sports media most uses to describe women. And with men, it was fastest, strongest, best. And with women, it was married, unmarried, and aged. I mean, we've seen Serena Williams leave press conferences in tears. And aside from asking questions that are, you know, not about tennis, even when we're talking about tennis, you know, we've seen Naomi Osaka ask questions like, wow, you lost to her last year. Is she in your head now? How are you going to handle this? You know, just things that I think if you are a person who suffers from anxiety, and even if you're not, don't put you in a great headspace either before or after a match. You know, I came into this in business as from a blogging side. So I didn't have access to these press conferences when I first started. And I still had to find ways to make things interesting, to engage readers. I think there's a way to do that. You know, I'm all for access by reporters, but I think that we need to have a conversation about what the parameters are, what the boundaries are. And I think that a lot of this is driven by the fact that we are seeing a very young woman of color set boundaries for people who are older than her, who are white. And that is something that we have not seen. And I think that's where a lot of the pushback's coming from.
I'm trying to figure out, has there been another moment like this? Can you think of one?
You know, I can think of Kevin Love coming out and talking about his mental health. DeMar DeRozan did the same thing. Michael Phelps. And I remember Zach Greinke in 2006 saying he almost quit baseball because he loved pitching, but he hated all the press around it. And it made him really anxious. And he, too, suffered from social anxiety. But I can't think of another case maybe I can think of one. Simone Biles not wanting to go train at the Corrali Ranch where so many gymnasts were abused, forcing USA Gymnastics to basically shut the ranch down and find another place to train. I mean, that was a pushback that actually resulted in, you know, some change being made. And I feel like we see a lot of people talk about their mental health after the fact.
You mean after they've retired?
Yeah, or without advocating for any specific change, just saying, you know, I have this and I want the world to know. And I, you know, if anyone else has it, just know you're not alone, which is a laudable thing to do. But I think what makes Naomi Osaka different is that she is advocating for change and she is pushing back against the status quo, a specific thing that she wants changed. And I don't think we've seen anyone do that. Certainly we've seen athletes skip a post-game press conference, but the way she tried to do it ahead of time by saying, this is what I'm doing. This is why, you know, and afterwards, I know I'm going to be fined. I hope the money goes to a mental health charity. And then after this is over, I'd like to talk to, you know, the powers that be about how we can do this differently. I don't think we've seen that kind of response or that kind of approach to this before. You know, certainly from someone so young, it's incredibly courageous.
You know, it's interesting. Is it the fans who think they own these athletes, or is it the leagues or the sports leagues or who think they own these athletes? And so therefore, whatever they do or say to them is considered fair game. Is that the word that comes to mind?
I think it's hard to argue with that. I mean, you know, shut up and dribble, infamously Laura Ingraham said to LeBron, I think is the attitude a lot of people have. I don't want to hear about your politics. I don't care about your personal life. Just go out there and entertain me. And when someone says, you know, I'm not going to do that, there are a lot of people who feel, look, you make a ton of money. You're famous. You have all these endorsement deals. Get out there and do what you're supposed to do. But, you know, that doesn't recognize athletes as fully formed emotional human beings. You know, I think we tend to feel that money erases all your problems, which is clearly not the case. And, you know, a lot of people sort of resent the fact that someone who already in their mind has so much more power than they do in terms of money and celebrity would say, you know, this is not okay, that they feel that you should be grateful for what you have and you should go out there and do what you said you were going to do. But that's never been the rule for the rest of us, right? I mean, in this country, if you have a disability, you have the right to ask for reasonable accommodation from your employer. Mm-hmm. Your employer has to make an effort to accommodate you. So, you know, if you can't stand the heat, stay out of the kitchen is not been the case for anyone's job. That's, you know, that's just not the way it goes. If you have a mental health disability, you're in, you know, entitled to ask your employer, this is something that would help me. Would you allow me to do this? And I think that's what she was making an effort at doing in a way that a 23-year-old who's grown up on social media does, which is just kind of throw it out to the world. But I didn't think her request was unreasonable in any way.
That's interesting because I'm thinking about other athletes, particularly athletes of color, who were always labeled as difficult because they demanded certain respect. I'm thinking about Roberto Clemente, mm-hmm. right? The famous, you know, the Pittsburgh great, who was consistently called Bobby by the sports media. I don't think Roberto is that hard to say. And was just viciously roasted by them until, of course, they started wearing, you know, winning World Series. And then all of a sudden it was, you know, it was OK. So I feel like what you're saying is there's also the aspect of being a person of color, which invites this kind of commentary. Do you think that that's also true of the men? Like I'm thinking about that the blackout by the English Premier League a couple of weeks ago, the soccer league where the players and coaches and many of the team management stayed off of social media to point up how many abusive communications are directed at athletes of color there. Do you think that the two are related? Are they related phenomena?
Oh, yeah, I think it's all related. I mean, I think anytime you have people of color who, especially who make a lot of money and who in the eyes of the fans, you know, maybe don't deserve it. You know, this is the same thing we see in Major League Baseball where people are constantly siding with the owners rather than with the labor, which are the players, you know, that the owners can take and diminish salaries and diminish salaries. And people always side with the billionaires, which is, you know, something I've never understood. And I think that race probably has a lot to do with it. I think back to last summer's Black Lives Matter protest by the WNBA and the NBA. WNBA sort of led the charge on that. And a lot of the comments on social media were shut up and play. Nobody cares about your opinion. So the idea, especially that players of color are supposed to just go out there, perform for all of us while we toss quarters at them and then go sit down and shut up is one that's been around this country for, you know, decades.
Which is interesting given how many people who own sports teams are involved in politics, who give massive political donations to the candidates of their choice. And even in the case of one of the NBA teams was a member of the United States Senate and certainly took political positions, but nobody told her to shut up. And, you know, so which is interesting. Where does this go next in your view? What could change look like in your view?
It's a really good question. You know, hopefully the people in the media who may ask more sort of tabloidy questions and stuff will think better of it. You know, I know that my colleague Jane McManus has talked about how what a great job the WTA did cracking down on reporters who sort of sexualized young women, young tennis players. So maybe we'll see sort of the same thing. You know, maybe people are just going to have to ask questions that aren't quite so that are, you know, related to tennis, first of all, and that don't just keep asking the same question over and over and over, particularly about someone's confidence or skill when they've just lost a match. You know, I just think that we need to be a little bit more sensitive than that. These are human beings. Many of them are very young, you know, particularly when we're talking about college athletes or, you know, someone in tennis where there's a lot of young players. Swimmers are young. NBA players are very young a lot of times. And I think we just need to, just talk to them the way you would talk to your child, not the way that you talk to someone who's an athlete who makes millions of dollars.
Julie DiCaro, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
And finally, an animal with an extraordinary talent. After 5 years of service in Cambodia, this landmine-sniffing hero rat is putting up his paws and starting a well-earned retirement. Magawa is a specially trained giant rat who, during his glory days, found no less than 71 landmines and 38 items of unexploded ordnance. Cambodia has one of the highest number of mine amputees per capita in the world, so his work really is life-saving. And last year, he became the envy of rodents everywhere as the first rat to receive the highest honor for animals, a medal for bravery from a top UK veterinary charity. An amazing story. Our hats off to him. And join me tomorrow for my conversation with Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. We'll discuss her new bill, which takes aim at sexual assault in the military and how she's crossing the aisle to try and get it through Congress. Well, that is it for now. You can always catch us online on our podcast and across social media. Thank you so much for watching, and goodbye from New York.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.